You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. To take the bright silver and gold you had taken from somebody else. We go riding in the damp, foggy midnight. You snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft time James Howard Kunstler says he wrote his 1993 book, The Geography of Nowhere, quote, because I believe a lot of people share my feelings about the tragic landscape of highway strips, parking lots, housing tracts, mega malls, junked cities, and ravaged countryside that makes up the everyday environment where most Americans live and work. This week, the show is devoted to his voice and his ideas, a James Howard Kunstler marathon. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. He's one of my favorite social analysts because he is one of the few who's been giving a voice to the outrage and despair so many of us feel at the ugliness that is the product of so-called prosperity in America. And he's making the connection between the destruction of our physical environment and the spiritual and intellectual deformation of our individual psyches and body politic. He attributes the ugliness of suburban sprawl and American architecture as some sort of failure of imagination or lack of confidence. I think there's another dimension, that it's a direct result of the bottom-line values of industrial capitalism and a legal system that strips people of the means to control the fate of our communities in the name of private property. The prevalence of big box and strip mall sprawl is one more example of the falsehood of the claim that the market gives the people what they want. People in communities all over America have fought mostly losing battles against big box stores and strip malls. Desperate people have been told this is the price they must pay for prosperity. Whose prosperity? The people who buy up the land and build the subdivisions do not live in them. They live in beautiful homes set on beautiful grounds, no strip malls in sight. Their estates were bought with the proceeds garnered from turning where we live into soulless hellholes, built on the cheap to maximize profit. Ugly emporiums filled with poorly made crap, disposable stuff for disposable people. Kunstler has been called a purveyor of gloom and doom by some as a result of his prediction of the collapse of consumer society due to peak oil. To me, this is a most hopeful message. Regular listeners to the show will be familiar with James Howard Kunstler and some of what he says you'll have heard before. As ever, he delivers his message in an entertaining style. For those not yet familiar with him, he's a journalist and author of 5 nonfiction books related to the issue of our built environment. Most recently, The Long Emergency, about the context of peak oil and energy descent. He's also written 8 novels and is an accomplished painter as well. He lives in Saratoga Springs, New York. Our first selection is an interview with him done last fall by Duncan Crary, co-host of the Humanist Network News, a monthly podcast produced by the Institute of Humanist Studies in Albany, New York.
James Howard Kunstler, something horrible has happened to the human habitat over the past 60 years. I wonder if we could begin this discussion by having you read a brief passage from the introduction to your 1993 book, The Geography of Nowhere.
I'd be pleased to, Duncan. Thank you very much. 30 years ago, Lewis Mumford said of post-World War II development, quote, "The end product is an encapsulated life spent more and more either in a motor car or within the cabin of darkness before a television set," unquote. The whole wicked, sprawling, megalopolitan mess, he gloomily predicted, would completely demoralize mankind and lead to nuclear holocaust. It hasn't come to that, but what Mumford deplored was just the beginning of a process that, instead of blowing up the world, has nearly wrecked the human habitat in America. Ever busy, ever building, ever in motion, ever throwing out the old for the new, we've hardly paused to think about what we are so busy building and what we have thrown away. Meanwhile, the everyday landscape becomes more nightmarish and unmanageable every year. For many, the word development itself has become a dirty word. 80% of everything ever built in America has been built in the last 50 years, and most of it is depressing, brutal, ugly, unhealthy, and spiritually degrading. The jive plastic commuter tract home wastelands, the Potemkin village shopping plazas with their vast parking lagoons, the Lego block hotel complexes, the gourmet mansardic junk food joints, the Orwellian office parks featuring buildings sheathed in the same reflective glass as the sunglasses worn by chain gang guards, the particle board garden apartments rising up in every meadow and cornfield, the freeway loops around every big and little city with their clusters of discount merchandise marts, the whole destructive, wasteful, toxic, agoraphobia-inducing spectacle that politicians proudly call growth. The newspaper headlines may shout about global warming, extinctions of living species, the devastations of rainforests, and other worldwide catastrophes, but Americans evince a striking complacency when it comes to their everyday environment and the growing calamity that it represents. I had a hunch that many other people find their surroundings as distressing as I do my own, yet I sense, too, that they lack the vocabulary to understand what's wrong with the places they ought to know best. That's why I wrote this book.
Mm. And then I marked another passage for you a little bit later on in the intro, if you could read that, please.
Okay. I suppose that my experience in suburb, city, and town life left me biased in favor of town life, at least insofar as what America had to offer in my time. That bias is probably apparent in the chapters ahead, but all places in America suffered terribly from the way we chose to arrange things in our post-war world. Cities, towns, and countryside were ravaged equally, as were the lesser order of things within them, neighborhoods, buildings, streets, farms, and there is scant refuge from the disorders that ensued. The process of destruction that is the subject of this book is so poorly understood that there are few words to even describe it. Suburbia, sprawl, overdevelopment, conurbation, Mumford's term, megalopolis. A professor at Penn State dubbed it the galactic metropolis. It is where most American children grow up. It is where most economic activity takes place. Indeed, I will make the argument that this process of destruction and the realm that it spawned largely became our economy. Much of it occupies what was, until recently, rural land, destroying, incidentally, such age-old social arrangements as the distinction between city life and country life. To me, it is a landscape of scary places, the geography of nowhere, that has simply ceased to be a credible human habitat. This book is an attempt to discover how and why it happened and what we might do about it.
James Howard Kunstler, thank you so much for reading that.
Oh, you're welcome.
You are probably the loudest critic of suburban sprawl.
Well, I'll try to whisper from now on.
Today, but I've heard you speak many times, and you have visual images that are very important to your talk. I know we're on the radio here now, but so much of what you say about suburban sprawl and horrible architecture is very funny. And I wanted to, I mean, you have things like you refer to buildings as Darth Vader's helmet or the Death Star. And of course, with a picture on the screen, the audience goes wild.
Yeah, it's sort of a comedy act. It sort of evolved into a comedy act. But, you know, I was a theater student in college. That was my major, believe it or not. And I was exposed to Samuel Beckett at a tender age. And Samuel Beckett put it very well. He said, nothing is funnier than unhappiness. Mm. And, you know, so these environments cause us so much unhappiness, so much distress, that they're a source of comedy. When you see a Laurel and Hardy comedy from the 1920s, you know, these two morons, you know, hitting each other with 2x4s and dropping pianos on each other, or, you know, even a Tweety Bird cartoon, what we're seeing is people hurting each other, but we laugh. Getting hit by a 2x4 in reality is not a pleasant thing. In fact, it can kill you. Mm-hmm. But when you see it on stage in a film or something, it becomes funny because we identify with the pain of it. And so the pain of our everyday environments in America is so extreme. They're so bad. They suck so egregiously, you know, all that's left finally is humor.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite one-liners you've come up with? I know you were talking about how Walmart and stores like Walmart always display a patriotic totem to warn off all criticism, which would be so many flags.
Yeah, the reason that we see flags flying over the Denny's restaurants is not because they really, you know, give a damn about the war in whatever country we're in at the moment. But it allows them to put up crappy buildings that can't be criticized. So the flag is a totem warding off criticism. And that's why we see so many of them, especially in front of the corporate headquarters. They always had the little ensemble, you know, of the three flags, the state flag, the town flag, and at center, the U.S. flag.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about how different building, like, well, you can't see the Walmart from the Target because of the curvature of the earth.
Yeah, well, you just said it for me. Right, because, you know, our the streets and then the parking lots are so huge, the scale is so huge, that you end up feeling like you're in a surrealist painting, you know, that you can't find the horizon really, you know. Uh-huh. You're sort of lost in space out there. And to be lost in space is really extremely distressing. And one of the reasons that the whole success of urban design depends on defining space well is that people don't like to be lost in space. Mm-hmm. They like to know where they are. They like to know where things begin and end, mm-hmm. you know.
I heard you giving your TED talk. You had a picture of a street with two, you know, juniper shrubs or whatever, and in a bark mulch bed. And you described one as the mothership, and then R2-D2 and C-3PO.
Yeah, there were three of them. There was a big juniper shrub and two little junior ones, and yeah, they were exploring the planet to see if they could colonize it. But you know, they were doing a chemical analysis of the bark mulch to see if they could live there. But, you know, that was a comment on the idiocy of our landscaping design, which tends to be used as a nature band-aid to mitigate the failures of our architecture, because our buildings suck so badly. Mm-hmm. You know, we think that if we stick a little, bark mulch bed with juniper shrubs in front of them, that it makes it okay. Mm-hmm. But that gets back once again to this idea, which I think is really crucial to understanding this, that we have no confidence in our ability to create urban places. And so nature is always the default setting for the cure. And so where this stuff is concerned, you know, this is why you see so many stupid landscaping fantasias around American cities and suburbs, because our buildings are so bad, we're constantly trying to hide them behind, you know, beds of shrubs and crabapple trees and all that crap. And that's what we've been doing. We've had this idea that you know, if you've got a wounded or maimed or mutilated city, the cure is nature. And it usually is delivered in the form of a nature band-aid, you know, a planting bed full of, you know, stuff. What you're basically seeing is also a very deep typological confusion over what is inherently urban and what is rural, between what is in the town and what is in the country, and what belongs where. And typically what this involves is people trying to ruralize the city. Mm-hmm. You know, if your city is bad, you try to cure it by bringing the country into the city. Now, what we've demonstrated in about 50 years of doing this is that it's no cure at all. In fact, it only makes things worse. But it points out the our complete loss of understanding of how these things work, especially typologically. The urban things belong in the urban places, and the rural things belong in the rural places. You know, one of the things about the word open space, I tell lecture audiences all the time, delete that from your vocabulary. Do not ask for open space. Do not ask for green space, because they are abstractions. And if you ask for it, an abstraction will be delivered in the form of a, juniper shrub bed full of bark mulch. It's just, or you'll get what you get frequently as a cartoon of the local surrounding countryside. Like around here, we like to put up a cartoon of the Adirondack Forest in the middle of the city. You know, they did that in the middle of Glens Falls. And one of the most crucial real estate parcels in the absolute center of town, where they allowed this UFO Burger King to land about 14 years ago. And it was obviously such a disgraceful building at the center of their town, and so inappropriate, that they then went out and spent about $1 million on landscaping to conceal it. Mm-hmm. So what they succeeded in doing was putting a cartoon of the Adirondack Wilderness around this inappropriate building in the very center of their town. And the last thing we need is a cartoon of the Adirondack Forest in the middle of the town.
After reading your book and hearing you speak many times, the word suburbia has come to take on a new meaning for me. My interpretation of suburbia is to disconnect elements of the world and isolate them. And by doing so, it's like severing the head from the body of a human being. We've done this to our communities. We've also done this to the way we think. Am I far out there, or do you agree with
that? Oh, no. It's one of the chief characteristics of suburbia is its disaggregation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying desegregation, by the way. Disaggregation. Mm-hmm. The disassembly of the organs of civic life, and then the consequent isolation of them, mm-hmm. so that all the people live in one place, all the shopping occurs in another place, the offices are in a third place, mm-hmm. The industrial stuff's in a fourth place, mm-hmm. and all of it can only be accessed by cars. It's not designed well. Right. It's poorly designed. Mm-hmm. It's designed only to satisfy the traffic engineers, really. One of the great tragedies of the last, of the beginning of the 21st century is that our economy became about little more than building suburban sprawl. And this is an enormous problem because suburban sprawl is a living arrangement with no future. Mm-hmm. And you can state that categorically. And so what our economy has become is an organism devoted to building more stuff that has no future.
A guest that I had on this show last month, Richard Dawkins, made a bold statement once about how raising a child, identifying your child with a religion, is a form of child abuse. And I want to ask you, is raising your child in suburbia a form of child abuse? And maybe I should even say, is raising a teenager in suburbia a form of child abuse?
Well, it is a good point. I would hasten to say that I think we overdo the whole abuse angle a lot. We're kind of hysterical. We become hysterical Puritans in that sense in our time. But it may be a response to the fact that we are in fact inflicting a lot of damage on ourselves and find that we can't stop doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't stop inhabiting our suburban environments because we've invested so much of our national wealth in them. Mm-hmm. They're there. The vast housing tracts and et cetera, they're there. And they are indeed very punishing for the development of children. Mm-hmm. Little children, that is children between 5 years old and, let's say, 14, they require certain things growing up in a human habitat that they don't get in suburbia. The main thing is that they need to develop this thing called their personal sovereignty, the management of their own body in time and space. And that means, learning to make their own decisions about, like, how to get home from school in time for dinner, mm-hmm. or how to get from school to the clarinet lesson and then back home again by their own devices without the assistance of somebody else. Now, this is something that, you know, the average eight or nine-year-old can learn how to do successfully. I learned how to do it in Manhattan when I was a kid. No problem. I got on a Lexington Avenue bus, and I went up, you know, 20 blocks from my grammar school, went to my music lesson, and got home by myself. But now, the way that our towns are, you know, our suburbs are designed, you know, kids as old as 14 have to be ferried around, or 15 or 16 have to be ferried around by the family chauffeur. The upshot is they don't develop any ability to manage themselves in time and space. And that's a very fundamental thing. But it gets worse than that. You know, kids between the age of about 7 and 15 also have to learn a whole set of social skills, like how to spend money, you know, how to order food in a restaurant, how to behave in a public place. Mm-hmm. You know, the public places in suburbia are the leftover scraps, the berm between the Walmart and the Kmart. You know, and you know what kind of behavior goes on up there? Teenagers go up there and they torture kitty cats and they smoke, you know, animal tranquilizers and they make homemade tattoos. And, you know, that's what happens there. But, you know, kids who grow up in a civilized environment, like, a town that has actually integral parts to it where they can get from one place to another, you know, they go down to the coffee shop here in Saratoga. Mm-hmm. They're allowed in there, by the way. You know, there's no restriction on being a kid. You can go in with your girlfriend if you're 15 years old and, you know, or 16 and drink coffee. And, you know, you can't torture kitty cats and smoke, you know, crystal meth and do homemade tattoos in a coffee shop. Because if you do that, they throw you out. They ask you to leave. So kids experience that. They're socialized. You know, they begin to learn the social skills necessary to be adults, how to conduct themselves in public places, how to, you know, what not to do, and they successfully do this. In suburbia, they don't get that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what you get is just incredible, huge volumes of terrible behavior. And they're usually unsupervised. You know, there are no adults around to regulate, you know, torturing the kitty cats and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, if there were sensitive adults around, that wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. It ends up being a, you know, rather than an abusive environment, I would say an environment that does not successfully prepare kids to be successful, caring adults.
Well, let me ask you to describe to us a healthy urban block.
A really successful town is made up of integral parts. You know, you think of these as the organs of the larger organism of the city or the town. And these organs are, you know, the residential organs where the people live, the commercial organs where, you know, commerce and trade take place, the manufacturing organs, the civic organs where we have our meeting halls and our town halls and the police station, mm-hmm. The cultural organs of the museum and the school, etc. So you have these organs of the city, and they're deployed in an integral way so that things are connected seamlessly, so that most people can get to these things easily without prosthetic assistance, mm-hmm. namely the car, and in a way that makes it comfortable and indeed even beautiful, you know, that allows them to enjoy the journey from one organ to the other in a way that is psychologically rewarding. And, of course, anybody who's been to a European city understands this. You know, you go to Rome, you go to Florence, you go to Paris, you go to, Munich, because they didn't throw their cities away the way we did. They didn't lose the integral nature of the true urban organism. Mm-hmm. And so you go around these places and you're going from, you know, the place that you're living or staying to the place where you're getting, you know, breakfast or coffee or going to an office or a museum or something. And the journey of going from point A to point B is very rewarding. You know, you're seeing things that were created deliberately to be beautiful, mm-hmm. to reward the human spirit. You're not encumbered by obstacles. You know, you don't have to cross an 8-lane freeway, generally, yeah. to get from one to the other. The main characteristic of a healthy urban organism is that it is scaled to the energy diet that is available to it. Now, unfortunately, much of the 20th century in America provided an energy diet that was really abnormal because that was the height of the cheap oil fiesta and the cheap natural gas fiesta. And it allowed these sort of hypertrophic growth, a kind of abnormal hyper growth of our cities, and then there, you know, the suburban asteroid belts that grew up around them. Mm-hmm. And we created these urban organisms that were, they're scaled to something that cannot be sustained. They outgrew any possible energy diet that they would probably be left with after the peak of the oil era. Mm-hmm. And when we entered that arc of decline, mm-hmm. which we're now entering.
We're listening to an interview with Duncan and James Howard Kunstler. Can't explain how they love them all.
In your book, Home from Nowhere, in the end, you have a personal note about yourself. And you mentioned that you're not... You're not religious. You weren't raised in a particularly religious household. But what word do you use to describe the interaction between humans and their habitat? Do you use a word like spiritual well-being, or there's something intangible in the human essence that requires a certain bit of aesthetic appeal, or what terms do you use?
I use a number of terms that I think explain at least, you know, provide a framework for understanding this. You know, I think that our environment, I think that we are to some extent hardwired neurologically to feel either good or bad depending on what's around us. And that this tends to be universal in human beings. You know, there are variations, and some people feel claustrophobic when they're in spaces that are too defined, and some people feel agoraphobic when they're in places that are overly open. But, you know, I think the average person likes to feel secure within the boundaries of a coherent, comprehensible place. They like to know where things begin and end. They like to see the idea of order expressed in, you know, the rhythms and patterns of things in architecture, and that's why we have things like columns and pilasters and, mm-hmm. you know, and brackets and all this, you know, all these architectural adornments and devices, because they're not all ornaments. Some of them are structural things, obviously. I think that we need these things psychologically. And you could extend that, of course, to, you know, a kind of a spiritual realm, because I'm not a pure determinist or anything. Mm-hmm. I may not be religious, but I do think that we have a spiritual dimension to us. And we do, you know, there is such a thing as beauty. Mm-hmm. There is such a thing as the tension of opposites. There's there are the deep mysteries of eros and eroticism and sex, which are not limited to sex, which actually extend into culture and inform a great deal of what comprises beauty for us. In fact, there's a wonderful book called On Beauty by Elaine Scarry. She makes the interesting point, which very few people have noticed, that one of the great crimes of modernist architecture is that it removed anything feminine from architecture. All the curves, you know, all the flowers, you know, anything that we remotely associate with female sensuality was deliberately left out.
Yeah.
And it's odd that even the women in our culture don't complain about that, you know?
But that's why you wrote The Geography of Nowhere, you said, to give people a vocabulary to complain about that.
Yeah, so, you know, so I've been trying to do that. So that's what I did. And, you know, we'll get beyond this, not because I'm complaining about it, but because circumstances are now developing that are going to compel us to do things differently, and we will. And it's going to change everything about how we live, and it's going to change our ethos and our aesthetic and our value system and our concept of who and where we are. We're going to be a very different people when we exit the cheap energy era.
I hear a lot of people talk about alternative fuels. I don't care about alternative fuels to the same degree, and I'll tell you why. Because I don't want to live in a world where I have to drive my car everywhere. I want to live in a well-designed world where I can live near where I work, and I can enjoy recreation opportunities near where I work. And I feel like if they came up with some magic fuel to power everyone's SUV, I'm still stuck in this dystopian geography of nowhere. So I want to return to have you explain a little bit more about.
I want to talk to you about this thing, this question you've raised, because okay. It's a very important one.
Okay, let's do that.
You know, unfortunately, there's a tremendous body of fantasy that is now has now grown among the American public about how we're going to keep on running our cars at all costs by other means than gasoline, mm-hmm. and virtually all of these things now are fantasies. They're really very unreal. I mean, you can do them as science projects on a small scale, but they don't scale up to, you know, 200 million vehicles. You can run, you know, X number of vehicles on ethanol or biodiesel or, you know, French fried potato oil that's been used and thrown out. But can you run the entire U.S. automobile fleet and the interstate highway system in Walmart and Walt Disney world? You know, forget it. It ain't going to happen.
You've mentioned one of the main problems is that we're going to have to grow way more crops than we do now to create things like
that. The whole thing is just a total fantasy. You know, I mean, it's basically all these alternative fuels, as far as liquid fuels for cars goes, they're all net energy losers. They are not going to – and also the way you've defined the problem is actually another layer of it that's much more important, which mm-hmm. is we're right back into the diminishing returns of technology. Yeah. You know, if we enabled ourselves to drive our cars for another 100 years, we'd completely destroy the North America, mm-hmm. not to mention the rest of the planet. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, this is self-evident. The thing that is, for me, the most painful is to travel among the environmental community, mm-hmm. which I do a lot these days because I do a lot of college lectures and, you know, I go all around the country constantly and I'm rubbing elbows constantly with real high-toned environmentalists. And to an individual, they are absolutely preoccupied with finding some snazzy new way to run their cars. And they come up to me, you know, and they tell me that they just got a Prius. You know, they want me to pin a brownie point, give them a brownie point or pin a medal on them. Mm-hmm. And it drives me crazy because, you know, they don't seem to have any sense of consequence about, you know, what this actually leads to. If they would put a fraction of their mental energy into thinking about walkable communities or into really, you know, into retrieving really good urban design, mm-hmm. We would benefit a lot more. Or if they put a tenth of their energy into the real important project that we face as far as transportation is concerned, which is restoring the American passenger railroad system at all levels, mm-hmm. you know, that's what we really need. That's what we need the environmental people to put their energy into, not to spend all their time thinking about how we're going to run cars differently the way Amory Lovins does mm-hmm. at the Rocky Mountain Institute. It has such farcical dimensions that it's almost beyond belief that this is what the intelligent minority of American people are preoccupied with.
Because I feel that environmentalists in America have also fallen under the plague of suburban thinking. They're isolating environmental
issues.
Oh, absolutely.
These guys, listen, to a person, these people want to live at the end of a 20-mile dirt road connected to their society by the umbilical cord of their car. But this gets to another thing that is essential about understanding the problem of suburbia. The great promise of suburbia, and one of the reasons that the environmental community is suckered into it, is that it promises to allow you to live an urban life in the rural setting. You know, one of the things that this represents is the fact that we have absolutely no faith in our ability to create urban environments at all. So the default setting for us now is that, you know, we have to live in the country or some cartoon version of it because our ability to create cities is so bad. Our cities suck so badly. They're so unrewarding. They're so ugly. They're so poorly organized. They're so unintegrated. They're so psychologically defeating. They generate so much anxiety and depression mm-hmm. that the default setting for the remedy for this is nature. We don't even want to think about what you know a human construct could be that could be good. Mm-hmm. And so we put absolutely no effort into understanding how to do this. And that's one of the reasons that the environmental movement has been completely uninterested in urban design per se, because the human habitat doesn't interest them.
Right.
You know, and when I go around, one of the things that I notice that you know is also disturbing is that the environmental community generally tends to view this thing they call the environment, with quotes around it, mm-hmm. as having value only for recreation or scenery.
Right.
I mean, they don't even value it for agricultural farm production. That says something about where we're at. And I hasten to add, I'm hammering on the environmental community here, but I'm a registered Democrat. You know, I'm not a neocon. I'm not a Republican. Mm-hmm. I'm not a conservative. I'm not a reactionary. But I think that the behavior and the ideology of the environmental community has been deeply out of sync with what we need to do in this country, which is to recreate a meaningful relationship between urban human habitats and a productive rural landscape, because we're going to have to produce our food differently in the future too. Industrial agriculture in this country is going to fail, along with all the other things that are dependent on cheap fossil fuels. I'm convinced that the disorders of the 21st century are going to return us to a lot of things that we used to do better, including designing better buildings and better towns.
Do you have any advice for our listeners as to what to do?
You bet. And the main thing is this, the same thing that I tell college audiences who universally say, can't you give me some hope? You know, first of all, you know, I think I'm a very cheerful, upbeat person. I'm not necessarily a rosy-eyed optimist, but, you know, I'm a happy person. And, you know, I believe that we're going to continue on. You know, the kids complain that they want hope. And I'm not a hope dispenser, you know, to passive consumers of hope. But what I tell them is that, you know, the main thing that distinguishes, I think, a successful adult from a child is that an adult knows the difference between wishing for stuff and making it happen. There's a whole long list of intelligent things that we can respond to this set of circumstances with. You know, we need to be out there actively fixing our civilization, reforming the way we do our farming and our commerce and our schooling and our trade, and building our cities and designing our homes and our buildings and all the things that are necessary to be part of a civilization. We're going to have to put a lot more thought and a lot more work into that. And as we do that, you know, I'm serenely convinced that we will become a much more hopeful people. In fact, if anything, you know, all the marvels and technological miracles of the last 100 years have only ended up producing a society which is profoundly unhappy, depressed, and anxiety-ridden. So we really have nowhere to go but up from here.
James Howard Kunstler, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's been a pleasure, Tom.
And the interviewer was Duncan Crary of the Humanist Network News, a monthly podcast produced by the Institute of Humanist Studies in Albany, New York. You can find them at humaniststudies.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
We're dancing on the ruins. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Say goodbye to plastic and goodbye to cars. No more convenience stores. Hello to stars. No more Wall Street and no more Pentagon. Thinking about these things makes me happy. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Goodbye to polystyrene, we'll put it into the waste. There is no time for debating, we have to make haste. If we're going to survive without computer program minds, we're going to have to can pop culture. Hungry to eat. Hello to primal consciousness and love for the land. Now corporations, dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Sayonara to suburbia and well-manicured lawns. Bye, bye, Barbie and Ken doll bonds. No more developers or slime ball execs. Your condos are on fire.
Fire!
Multinational corporations, ha, 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 ha. No more a Christian country will have pagan deities. And when we destroy technology, we all will be free. The pavement will be ripped up and the skyscrapers cut down. Yes, we are coming for your children. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations, dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha.
Casey Neal, Dancing on the Ruins of Multinational Corporations. We'll conclude our James Howard Kunstler Marathon with a recent talk he gave in Vancouver that comes to us thanks to the tireless efforts of Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. He'll introduce the talk.
It's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price.
No combination of solar or wind or tidal or nuclear or biodiesel or ethanol or used French fried potato oil is going to allow us to keep Walmart and the interstate highway system and Walt Disney World running.
Don't give me no shit about blood, sweat, tears, and toil. It's all about the price.
How will our cities and farms survive declining oil supplies? James Howard Kunstler is a persistent critic of suburbs, mega highways, and soulless strip malls. His two best-known books are The Geography of Nowhere and, more recently, The Long Emergency. Now Kunstler was appointed the first visiting scholar to the Urban Studies program of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. This speech captivated the overflow crowd at the SFU WASC Center in Vancouver, January 24, 2008. Out-of-town listeners should know that Surrey is a more or less unplanned bubble of suburbia outside Vancouver. Substitute your own satellite growth. Here is James Howard Kunstler.
Actually, I'm going to try to be on my best behavior tonight because I'm in Canada where people are polite. And I think you should act like the people who live in the country you're visiting. So I'll try to be very polite and... It has been kind of a humbling experience to be in Vancouver and to see this very interesting and complicated city that is so different from really 90% of the cities in the U.S., and I go around to a lot of them, you know. And some of the cities in the U.S. are still pretty alive, although I have a lot of questions about, you know, whether they're going to continue to function at the scale that they're that they've achieved. And indeed, really throughout this whole blab, one of the themes really is going to be at what scale can we conduct all of the important activities that make up our everyday life. But it's also been humbling because, you know, I've run into a lot of people over the last few days who have opinions that are quite different from mine, and you know, frankly, they may be just as valid as mine are, but they, you know, they can't contradict my ideas. So, you know, all of this is to say that the ideas I'm going to present are my point of view. Admittedly, that you know, I'm not trying to represent any group or anything. I've just these are just the conclusions that I've come to from living in the culture that I live in. You know, that we partially share. And so you can take them for what they are worth. This is, I gave a talk in Surrey at the Surrey campus a few days ago. And this talk contains about 37% of similar material, for those of you who happen to maybe have been to the other one. But it's not the same one. The Surrey talk was much more about the particulars of urban design per se. This is more about the nature of the predicament that we're in, but especially the group psychology of it, which fascinates me more and more. You know, why we do the things that, why do we continue doing the things that we're doing? And, of course, at the center of a lot of this is the whole issue of oil. Of course, the United States, my country, faces a great deal of trouble over this. We use a quarter of the world's oil every day. We started the oil industry and ramped it up to be the world's first great oil industry. But we got started pretty early, and we peaked pretty early. In 1970, and now there's a great deal of apprehension and anxiety that the world is peaking. When the United States, and by the way, I'm going to condense to some extent the oil discussion. I'm not going to go into a full-blown discussion of the so-called peak oil theory. And I'm more interested in sort of the current situation and the consequences. But when the United States peaked in its oil production at about 10 million barrels a day, in 1970, we began to then offset our problem as our production declined. We offset our declines by importing oil from other nations. Now that the world appears to have reached an oil production peak, we're not going to be able to go to other planets to import or to offset the falling production. And that's the problem, the essence of the problem. There are other facets of it we'll get into. Another important part of this is that it's not about running out of oil. You know, all the radio jockeys I talk to aren't. Are you saying we're running out of oil? Why we're not running out of oil? It's not about running out of oil. It's about what happens as you head down that slope, that arc of depletion, and weird things start happening. Namely, the complex systems that we depend on for everyday life start to get into trouble. Start to react to these problems, start to wobble, start to fail, and start to then ramify each other's failings. And these complex systems can be described with some precision. The way we produce our food, farming, in particular industrial agriculture, the way we do commerce and trade and manufacturing, namely making stuff and selling it, which has now become basically the Walmart model of the global corporation, national chain corporation with the huge supply lines all over the world, et cetera, et cetera. That's another complex system. The way we do transportation, get from one place to another, you know, the whole happy motoring paradigm, that's another complex system. The way we do schooling. Finance is one of particular interest to me and perhaps to some of you who are observing the scene out there. You know, finance, in a way, is one of the real canaries in the coal mine, because finance is it is in the nature of finance to operate by attempting to predict the future, to apprehend the future and understand the future and make sense of it by assigning prices to things. And one of the things we're seeing is that the stock and trade of finance, which is consists of certificates and currencies and paper markers that represent the expectation for wealth, these things are getting into trouble. They're losing their legitimacy. People are losing their confidence in them. And there's a reason why, because one of the major implications of the global oil predicament is that the sort of normal 2.5 to 9% growth that industrial economies enjoy year after year in a cyclical way, you know, some a little bit less one year, a little bit more next year, but always 3 to 9% industrial growth in industrial economies for 200 years, you know, this experience we've had. And in those 200 years, the stock markets have all grown up into their present form, and all of the instruments and certificates that they trade in have evolved to, you know, in their little niches to represent
little pieces of risk and, enterprise, ventures into enterprise. And all of a sudden, we're the main implication in finance of the oil problem is that we're not going to have that regular 2.5 to 9% growth, and hence the expectation or wish for that kind of normal behavior is not there. And it means that the things that represent that wish are going to start to destabilize. And that's exactly what you're seeing. But there are really interesting sort of a side elements of it. And since I'm so interested in the group psychology, you know, it fascinates me, for example. And I think this is you know, I do believe more and more in a kind of collective subconscious or collective imagination and collective psychology. Because as this problem got closer to us, you saw a lot of really inexplicable behavior on the part of people working in finance. You know, most notably, for the last 10 years down in the United States, all the bankers in the United States forgot that you need to lend money to people who have some prospect for paying it back. That's a system called norms and standards in lending. And how do you account for the fact that everybody in banking forgot it? You know, or just put it aside, you know, including people who are supposedly really smart, you know. So my explanation for that is that, you know, as this situation evolves and gets scarier and more unstable, that groups of people, including groups of professionals, sort of crack up and to some extent become kind of culturally psychotic within their own culture. You know, there's no question that the culture of finance became psychotic over the last 10 years. No other way of sort of explaining the perverse behavior that we've been seeing. And now, of course, as Robert Louis Stevenson says, we're feasting at the banquet of consequences over that. Well, getting back to my point, all these complex systems that we depend on are going to get into trouble. You know, as we get in trouble with oil depletion, the food system is going to get in trouble because we're going to, and that's exactly what's happening. Of course, it costs more and more to run the diesel combines and trucks and to make the fertilizer. We saw an interesting thing happen with the fertilizer the last 5 years when the price of natural gas really started to ramp up in 2003. A lot of the fertilizer plants in Arkansas and Louisiana closed down and moved their operations to the Middle East because. The natural gas, which is the main constituent for nitrogenous fertilizer, is much cheaper over there. And one of the consequences of that now is that we are now hostages for our food production for the fertilizer produced in the Middle East, not just the oil and gasoline. So interesting things are happening, and there are other elements of that, the food scene that we'll talk about. But it's all about the complex systems and what happens. Now, Over the last 2 years, some new storylines have been emerging in the larger oil soap opera, and they help us understand a little bit better how things will play out. And one of them is the oil export crisis. And what this simply means is we're discovering, as it appears that we passed the global peak in July of 2006. It appears that the numbers are telling us that the export rates in the nations that export oil are going down more steeply than their decline rates. So let's say a nation like Norway is now having a 4% decline every year in the North Sea of their production. You know, their export rates are going down even more steeply. For the really highly populated nations like Saudi Arabia, it's even more steep. And Iran, Venezuela, Mexico, especially. We'll get to that in a moment. The second new rub on the story is the whole plot line about oil nationalism. And this sort of has two elements to it. One is that only about 5% of the world's oil comes from the major oil producers like Shell, the private major oil companies, they used to call them the old majors, Shell, Exxon, etc. 95% of the world's oil now is coming from nationalized oil companies like Pemex and the Venezuelan National Oil Company and the Brazilian National Oil Company, Saudi Aramco, etc., the Iranian National Oil, the Russian companies, for all practical purposes, have their operations are now pretty much nationalized, et cetera, et cetera. And they are increasingly making favored nations, favored customer contracts, instead of putting their oil on the futures markets for auction. And that is going to increase more and more. It is happening more and more. And the United States, for one reason or another, is not so favored by many of these nations anymore. This is a problem for your south of the border neighbors. The North Sea and the United Kingdom are an interesting story, of course. The North Sea oil fields were among the last great fields to be discovered. They are shared by Norway and the UK. The UK has about 60 million people, and they not only sold off a great deal of their oil, but they also used up a lot of their own oil. And indeed, they did a lot of suburbanizing over the last 20 years, which is just a tremendous blunder. Norway has only 4.5 million people. They've used quite a bit less. And another part of the oil nationalism story, by the way, is that some nations like Norway, that are, nations long acquainted with civilized life, are going to keep more of their own oil after a certain point. And they're talking about it. They're making plans to do it. They're not so dumb that they're going to just piss it all away and then turn around and say, how are we going to keep our lights lit or, whatever we need to do with our oil? So increasingly, that's a big deal. Anyway, the North Sea fields were among the last to be discovered, and they were exploited with the latest and greatest technology. And guess what? We never pay any attention to the unintended consequences of technology, but it's a big deal. And the unintended consequence of drilling the North Sea with the latest and greatest technology, horizontal drilling, injections of seawater to pump, get the oil out, the consequence of that was they depleted the North Sea more efficiently. So now the UK has gone from peak production in 1999 to having no exports at all, becoming a net importer of energy in 2006. And that's a remarkable thing. The poster child for the export crisis, Mexico. Mexico gets 60% of all of its oil from one single super giant oil field called the Cantarell Field. It is depleting at a minimum of 15% a year, although Pemex actually announced in September that it was in 2007 it actually depleted at 17%. And so if you do the simple math, you can see that in a few years it's all gone. So in a few years, 60% of Mexico's oil production will be gone. And well before then, they will lose their ability to send oil to the United States. Now, they happen to be our number three source of imports. Who's our number one source? Right. And number two, of course, Saudi Arabia. So they're number three. And so this means within, before 2010, the U.S. is probably going to lose its number three source of imports. And guess what? That'll have an enormous impact on how we behave in the United States. And there's nothing that we know of that's going to offset that. And meanwhile, export declines are going to continue in all the other countries that send us oil. So for us, it's a tremendous problem. Another problem is that the Mexican government depends on Pemex for 40% of its revenue. So they're going to lose a huge amount of basically tax money, revenue. The social safety net, or what there is of it in Mexico, is going to dissolve, the subsidized tortillas, et cetera. And the last time there was a political convulsion in Mexico, the last time the people became seriously pissed off at their government, 25% of the population of Mexico left. And at that time, the population was 22 million. Now the population of Mexico is over 100 million. So if there's another political convulsion, we're going to have a lot more trouble at the southern border of the United States than we have been. So there are a lot of implications to this. Climate change has been adequately covered by Al Gore, and I don't mean to give it short shrift, but those of you who want to learn about it in detail, go, rent his excellent movie and learn about it. The only point I want to make here is that the problems of climate change and the global oil predicament are going to ramify each other as well. And we saw an excellent example of it in Hurricane Katrina, Category 4-5, hurricane, probably a result of global warming, climate change. You know, we had two force five hurricanes within about a month that year. And they not only did they destroy a major American city, but they also took out 23% of our oil and gas production, at least for the better part of a year after that. So these problems affect each other. And climate change, global warming is certainly very important, but forgive me for not dwelling on it. There are other things I want to talk about tonight.